This is Richard Roth with The Passage on WGXC. My guest this month is Amy Saltz, a theater director I've known since the early 1970s when we met at the Napa Valley Theater Company in California. I'd like to dedicate this particular show to our mutual friend Kelly English, who died in the first tsunami of AIDS in the 1980s.
This is Richard Roth, and I'm in the studio with Amy Saltz, a theater director whom I have known since 1972. Welcome, Amy.
Hi, Richard. Nice to be here.
Now, you've been coming to Copaic Lake since you were...
Nine years old. It's been a long time. Yes.
And pretty much, unless you've been traveling, you've kind of always come up. I've been working somewhere or traveling.
Yeah, and I my parents owned it originally, obviously. And then when they passed away, I got it, and that was about 20 years ago. So more than 20 years ago. So since then, I've been here as much as possible. And now that I was the head of a theater directing program at Rutgers University, and I stepped down from that job. So now that I'm not tied to that schedule and that job, I've been spending much more time here, and it's pretty fabulous.
It's a gracious house with a beautiful flower garden that your mother put in.
Yes.
And so all this time you've been working at Rutgers and also doing directing projects.
I mean, basically I've been a freelance director, and then I also was working at Rutgers, and I was part-time there for years while I was running around the country doing plays. I'm based in New York City. I've worked at most of the regional theaters around the country. I've worked in Europe. I've worked in Russia, Estonia. But keep coming back here. And then I was, for the last 12 years, I've been the head of the program. They made me full-time, and I ran the program. But I have to say that I've been all over the country. I've been to these amazing, beautiful places in the United States and in Russia and, as they say, Estonia and Greece, and, you know, all over the place. And I come back to Columbia County, and I'm blown away by how beautiful it is. We spent yesterday, my partner and I, driving around and looking at the incredible colors, and I kept saying, we live in one of the most beautiful places in the world.
When we first met you, the first play you directed that I ever saw was What the Butler Saw by Joe Orton.
Oh, my God.
And, and you did a variety of things. Do you have any specialty, or do you direct all kinds of shows?
I direct all kinds. I have a strong background in classical theater and Shakespeare and other classical theater. But there came a time in my career where I felt that I needed to make a choice, and I needed to focus so that I was either going to try to do Shakespeare and classical work, or I was going to try to do new plays, because I needed an image that wasn't just being a woman director, because that was what I was a woman director. There were practically no women directors when I started. There were like three that I know about. One was Joan Littlewood in England, Pat Brown in Texas, Zelda Fitchandler in Washington, and I think that was about it. I mean, there probably were a few others, but not very many. And so that was the reputation that I had very quickly, was, oh, this is a woman director, which meant that I kept getting offered shows by women playwrights. And there was a period when the NEA was giving grants to theaters to hire women directors. And I was often, in those early days, I was the woman that they chose, because, I don't know, I was the woman director whose name was around. So in ways it was great for me, but it was also very limiting. So I had to redefine myself, because anytime anybody offered me anything that wasn't a play by a woman, I would just jump at it, because that's not how I wanted to be defined, and it's not the only work that I wanted to be doing. I certainly wanted to be doing some plays by women that were good plays by talented women, but it wasn't the only thing I wanted to be doing. So I basically made the choice to start focusing on new work, because I was New York-based and I wanted to be able to spend time in New York. And I figured that was, I'd have a better chance of doing that if I was focused on doing new work than if I was focused on doing classics. So, in a way, my specialty became new work.
And then within that definition, it could be a comedy, a serious drama. Whatever.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And I was very fortunate to get involved with the Eugene O'Neill National Playwrights Conference, which was the first real playwrights conference. There are a lot of them around now, and many of them have been copies of the O'Neill or offshoots of the O'Neill. But the O'Neill was really the first, and it was run by Lloyd Richards, who was an extraordinary man. George White was the producer, and George White was the person who conceived of the idea of having a playwrights conference, and then he brought Lloyd in to run it. And Lloyd was a black director who had directed the original production of Raisin in the Sun, and he is one of the smartest, most genuine people that I ever met, with a huge capacity for helping nurture artists, theater artists particularly.
That's in New York, the O'Neill?
It's in Connecticut, in New London, or Waterford, Connecticut. It was near where O'Neill lived. It is on the grounds of the Harkness estate.
Harkness from the dance world?
Yeah, Rebecca Harkness. There's a Harkness State Park right next to it. But I don't think it was it. I'm thinking of, there's a character in Moon for the Misbegotten whose name is Harker, who's the bad landlord who lives next nearby, and doesn't get along well with the family in Moon for the Misbegotten because their cows are drinking out of his ice pond, drinking water out of his ice pond. But I can't remember the family's name right now. It'll come to me. But it's the main house is supposedly the house that O'Neill based Morning Becomes Electra on. I mean, that he placed it in that house. And O'Neill used to like to go down to the beach there, this beautiful little beach. And the owner used to take pot shots at him with his rifle because he couldn't stand that this, you know, young degenerate, as far as he was concerned, was walking on his property. But we could see from the porch of that house where we used to eat breakfast all the time, we could see Ocean Beach, which is the amusement park, where in the play Our Wilderness, the young couple goes down and has a very wonderful romantic scene on the beach at Ocean Beach.
And you would be in residency then for...
We were in residence there for a month. We would work on new plays. We would develop 16 plays each summer, and each play was given a director and a dramaturg. And we had the most amazing actors because it was a place that people came to have an enormous respect for, because a lot of very important people from contemporary theater came through the O'Neill. I mean, I worked with August Wilson, Lee Blessing, John Prakovich Shanley, just a whole slew of... Wendy Wasserstein was there, Chris Durang, most of the important playwrights of, you know, of that era, the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, came through there. And it's still going strong. They now have a school attached to it, the National Theater Institute, and a musical theater school, which is just starting. There's a cabaret. I mean, that helped. There's been a whole resurgence in the appreciation of cabaret. And a lot of that came from the O'Neill, because they started this cabaret symposium or conference where people would come up and work on cabaret material. And again, work with the most established people in the field. So it was an amazing place to work. I was there for 17 years.
Starting what year?
1981. Actors that I hired right out of... like graduate school, John Turturro, Charles Dutton, Kevin Kline had just done, I think he had just done Sophie's Choice a year or two before, and I ran into him on the street. I knew him from the acting company, which was another group that I worked with. And I said, hey, you know, you wouldn't be interested in coming up to the O'Neill, would you? And he was like, yeah, sure, I would love to. So he came up, and Jill Eikenberry and Michael Tucker from L.A. Law fame were there. It was just an amazing group of people. Angela Bassett was there.
Now, when you say your background had been in classical, was that at the Public Theater?
Yeah, when I was in college, I started working for Joe Papp with the New York Shakespeare Festival, and I stayed with them for probably, I don't know, like 7 years in one capacity or another, and that was I consider that to have been my graduate school, but it was all very hands-on, and I was working with Joe, and I was working with Gerald Friedman, who was the artistic director of the Shakespeare Festival for a while, including when they started the Public Theater. Jerry directed Hair and was really the reason why Hair, or a lot of the reason why Hair happened, because he read it and he heard the music, and he and John Morris, who was his musical collaborator, both thought it was an extraordinary piece of theater, or had the potential of being an extraordinary piece of theater, and it was the first rock musical, and they thought the music was really terrific and that it would be a wonderful way to open the Public Theater, and they talked Joe into it, and I worked on it. I was the assistant director on it.
Oh, you were?
Yeah. And that was the original production, which then eventually it got taken over by another group of people and went to Broadway. After we did it, we did it at the Public, and then it had a 6-week run there, and then they had to move it because we had a season, so there was another show that had to come into the Public, and we moved it up to the Cafe Cheetah, which was a disco place up on 50 something street, and we had 4 days to move the show into the theater, which takes a lot of work. It had to be restaged, relit. It had to be redone. And the writers of Hair, Rado and Ragney, kept running after Jerry and saying, Jerry, we have this new song and we want to put it in. And Jerry would say, no, we don't have time. And then they come up the next day and they say, Jerry, we have 3 new songs, we want to put them in. And the new songs were What a Piece of Work Is Man, Happy Birthday, A.B. Baby. I don't know, there was just, you know, again, more songs that have to this day become classics. It was an amazing ride working on that production and then to see it become what it became.
And then from there,
I worked at the Shakespeare Festival for about 7 years, and I started there as a gopher, literally running around getting coffee for people, and ended up assisting Jerry. I assisted Joe on shows. I assisted Jerry on shows. Joe gave me and somebody else, another young director, whose name was Ted Cornell, he gave us a theater to run in the Public. I mean, it was the second theater there, which is now the Susan Shiver Theater. But it was this little theater, and he said, do whatever you want. So we did. But after a while, I felt like I had to try something else. I felt like Joe Papp was my father, and Jerry Freeman was my mother, and I had to break away from home a little bit, you know, had to flex my own muscles and see what I could do on my own. I went to a little theater way up in Warren County, and they were working on a new play. I mean, I did a production there, A Taste of Honey, but they were working on a new play with music, and they needed a director for it, and they played the music for me, and I loved it. I started crying when I heard one of the songs. But the book was awful, and I said, well, I like this music a lot, and I think it's really wonderful. And I love this company of young, it was all very young, non-equity actors, very energetic, very innocent, and very talented. And I said, I love this company, and I love the spirit of this company. And the book of this show is terrible. And if we could throw the book out, keep the music, and develop a new piece really based on the strengths of the company, I would be interested in doing that. And they said, okay. So that's what we did. And that became a play called Touch. And we brought it into New York, and it ran for a year and a half in New York. We got nominated for a Grammy Award. We got incredible reviews. Part of what was shocking to me was that I had an off-Broadway show that was running for a year and a half. I didn't get one offer for another play, to direct another play. And I didn't understand it. Years later, I realized that it was because I was a woman. If I had been a man in that position, I would have gotten more work. People would have said, oh, he's a really talented young guy. Let's see what he can do. Didn't happen. And eventually, again, I felt like I had to do something else. And I had met Kelly English, who was a friend of Cara Landry, who was starting this theater company in the Napa Valley. And Kelly said, I have this friend who's starting a theater company in the Napa Valley. Want to come out? And I was like, sure. He said, well, let me introduce you. So I met Cara, and she was indeed starting this theater. She was about 21 or 22 years old. And she said, you want to come out? And I came out, and I directed the first show, and then, which was what the Butler saw. And then I stayed, and I became the associate artistic director there and kept directing shows and stayed for a couple years. And then it was time to move on again. I came back to New York.
One of the last ones you did, I think, was Elizabeth One. Is that correct?
I did do Elizabeth One. I don't remember where it was in the...
Which was... everyone thought it was wonderful. I remember, I think there was a theater in Marin County that they'd sort of bought out the inventory, the costumes and the lights and stuff. Do you remember that? I think it was the woman from this theater. Somehow or other, I happened to see that this person had written a note to Kara, and it said, Amy Saltz is a very talented young woman.
Oh, isn't that nice?
On the basis of that show, yeah.
The costumes for that were done by Betty Saar.
Yes, Betty
Saar. Who was this brilliant, brilliant artist from San Francisco that Kara had met.
Yeah, she had a show at the Whitney Museum not too long after that, as a matter of fact. She was a fantastic artist. Yeah, the costumes were particularly good. But the whole thing, it was a wonderful show. I mean, you must have been very proud at the time.
I was. And it had been a big kind of a risk for me because it took a kind of imagination that I hadn't really made use of, or I didn't have much practice with. Because it was, I don't remember a lot of the specifics from it, but there was a battle with the English and Spain that we had to put on stage, and it was a sea battle, and I was like, how do we put that on stage? And so we ended up doing it with puppets, and it was kind of magical, but it stretched me in ways that were really important for me, because I didn't know that I could do that, and I knew that it was important to try, but it was a blast.
And so then when you came back to New York, what did you start doing then?
I came back to New York, and I worked for a while with a group called Women's InterArt. That was, again, I came back to New York, and I started interviewing for jobs. And I kept getting people saying, we're not going to hire a woman.
What was the reason? Just they hadn't had enough experience with women?
I had one guy who said, well, you seem very talented, but if you're anything like my wife, you're out of commission 4 days out of the month, and I can't deal with that. And I was like, but that wasn't me. I was never out of commission. I had more energy, more stamina, more, you know, give it to me, and I will climb to the top of the mountain, whatever it might be. But I got so angry and hurt and disgruntled by it all. I went to work for the Women's InterArt Center, which was a women's art center that had a theater program, music, photography, multiple interdisciplinary company, and I became a production coordinator there. And then Jerry Friedman, again, my mentor, became the co-artistic director of a group called the Acting Company that John Houseman, who was a very established theater and film producer, had started. John was also the first dean of the Juilliard School, the drama school.
It was a very prestigious company, actually.
The acting company. Extremely. And still is today. I mean, they still tour all over the country doing Shakespeare and other classics around the country. But John had put together the first class of Juilliard, which included Patti LuPone, Kevin Kline, and a host of other incredible actors. I mean, people who have gone on to become major figures in the American theater. And when they finished their 3 years at Juilliard, they were invited to come up to Saratoga, to the Performing Arts Center, to do a season up there. And John Houseman, who never gave up an opportunity and who was quite a visionary, thought, well, if we're going to do that, we might as well go on tour. So they put together a tour going around the country to universities and big cities around the country performing this repertory of classics. And it became very successful. And as I say, it still is functioning today.
And what were some of the plays at that point? And,
at that point, we did Mother Courage. We did a play called Italian Straw Hat, which was a musical that Alfred Urey, who wrote Driving Miss Daisy, he and a guy named Robert Waldman wrote it. We did King Lear, that John Houseman directed. We did a production of Camino Real that Jerry Friedman directed, that Tennessee Williams came to see, and we all got to meet Tennessee Williams, the writer with a martini in his hand, and very gracious and a little tipsy. We did a production of David Mamet's. He had a one-act play called The Duck Variations that Gerald Gutierrez directed, and Gutierrez went on to become a very well-known director in New York and around the country. And, oh, I don't know, we were doing, I think, The Robber Bridegroom we did with Kevin Kline and Patti LuPone.
And so how long did that touring go on then with him?
I stayed with the acting company for 3 years. And then after I left, they would periodically call me and say, we need help with something. Would you go back out on the road and help take care of whatever problem had come up? And I also worked on an original play that we developed for the company that was about women writers. And it became a very successful play that we were on the tour. And we did a workshop of it in New York when we were developing it, which Lloyd Richards came to see, which I think is why I ended up getting asked to come to the O'Neill. You know, those little connections that you never know are going to lead anywhere, but so often somebody remembers you from somewhere and says, oh, I remember that person, I want to bring them here.
Now, when you say you were developing the show, do you as director then sort of become a collaborator in a way?
Yeah. That was, we had the idea, on that show, we had the idea of doing a play about women playwrights, and I was working with a woman named Eleanor Jones, who was a wonderful writer, and I kept feeding her material, because I had read a lot of literature, a lot of books by and about women writers. I mean, also, I read a lot of books by and about men writers, but I had some real favorites, like Virginia Woolf and Catherine Mansfield and, I don't know, a whole slew of writers who I really thought were extraordinary. And I kept feeding her books and essays and whatever. And then she would pick and choose from what I was giving her and started putting the play together. And then I would, you know, she'd give it to me and I would have feedback about whatever I thought was happening. And it went through a long developmental process. There was a director named Alan Schneider, who was a very well-known, a big Broadway director, who took over Juilliard and also took over the acting company after John Houseman and Jerry Friedman left. And Alan was also involved with the development of that script. And it went through many configurations and many, even ideas. Like, originally we had a bunch of little scenes that were put together from novels that ended up really going by the wayside. And it really became about the struggle of these women to become writers and to get published and them talking about their own source material and whatever it was else that they wanted to talk about. But like the Bronte sisters publishing under a different name because they couldn't get published as women. So they became Anton Bell, and that was Charlotte Bronte was Anton Bell.
Now, when you go out to when you're hired by a theater to come and direct a production, do you start with casting, or do you find a company already there? How does that work?
In terms of how to cast the show? Or
do you cast the show yourself? Do you work with companies that are already established sometimes where they pretty much have an acting company?
I do both. I'm doing something now with the Boise Contemporary Theater, which is a terrific small theater in Boise that does a lot of new plays. And they have resident people who are wonderful, who I've worked with someplace else. There's a playwrights conference out in Idaho called the Seven Devils Playwrights Conference. That's also a terrific organization that develops new plays and has done work helped develop plays by a lot of the younger writers, really good writers who are coming up now, Sam Hunter and Jen Silverman. There's a whole school of young writers, and some of them have come through Seven Devils along with other places. Sam just won a Genius Award, MacArthur Genius Award. But I had worked with an actor up there, who Matt Cameron Clark, who it turns out is the artistic director of the Boise Contemporary Theater. And I'm directing a play there that's written by the woman who runs Seven Devils Playwrights Conference, Jenny Mahoney. And so Matt is going to be in it, and there's another actor from Boise Contemporary Theater who's going to be in it. And then the two other actors we're hiring out of New York. And then there's another company I've been working with a lot, the Hartford Theater Works. And they don't have a resident company, so we hire everybody out of New York.
So you'll have auditions in New York, basically.
Yeah.
And do a lot of people come to those?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, Boise Contemporary Theater, I don't know because I haven't worked there yet. But Theater Works is a 300-seat theater. It's full all the time. The last two plays, actually, I did. Your listening audience might be interested in this, but the last two plays that I did were both written by John Cariani, who this summer was at Barrington Stage acting. Both this summer and last summer, he was there at Barrington Stage as an actor. Very multi-talented, wonderful guy. We usually work through a casting director and have, you know, like maybe 3 days of actors coming in, on 10-minute auditions. So they come in to have 10 minutes to show us their stuff, which is nothing. I mean, it's no time at all. But we get to see a lot of people in 3 8-hour days of seeing people for 10 minutes a day.
And then you'll call back.
And then we'll have callbacks and work more extensively with the people that I might be interested in.
Do you ever find that, you wished you'd hired somebody else? I mean, somebody you ignored in an audition? Maybe that's a
silly sure.
question.
You mean in later on and say, right. Oh, my God. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, there's always a reason why I hired whoever I hire when I hire them. But, I mean, years ago, John Goodman had just gotten into New York, and he auditioned for something, and I was really tempted to hire him, but he was incredibly shy, and he could barely talk. I mean, I could not get him to engage in conversation, and I was afraid to hire him, you know. And I don't know that I was wrong, but I think that, I mean, at the time, it seemed like the right thing to do, but I think he probably would have come around. He just had to get a little more comfortable. Then I hired him a little later. A couple of years later for something else, he came in again, and I was like, I want that guy, you know. But sure, I mean, there. I look back on some of those old casting sheets, and I'm like, oh, my God, this person came in or that person came in. That's pretty amazing. But it's also, it's really interesting to think about how people grow and change and mature over the course of a career. You know, and somebody who might not just, they might be a brilliant actor and just not know how to audition. Or they can be a brilliant actor and just be, you happen to need somebody tall for the role and they're a little too short for it, or vice versa. Or you need a blonde because they have to, or they have to play the daughter of so-and-so, and you want to have some kind of resemblance, and it just doesn't match for whatever reason. But for the actor, they never know what you're really looking for. So, and often it's just something that's a pure technicality is the reason they don't get the role. It can be somebody who's absolutely brilliant. That happened just recently. There's somebody who came in for the last show I was casting who I think is fabulous, and I couldn't cast her. I had to cast somebody else, but I want to work with that woman, you know?
Do you keep a kind of an archive of, you mentioned casting sheets. Do you keep an archive of
I keep them and I go back to them. I'll still go back to casting sheets that are 20 years old if I'm looking for somebody in that age range. And I take notes during the audition, and I hope I'll remember them in the future because I'm always, you know, you're looking and you just got to find ways to jog your own memory. I used to live in Manhattan Plaza, which was subsidized housing for people in the theater, and in Manhattan. And I used to do casting in the elevator, because I had seen a movie, and there was an actor in the movie who I thought was great, and he had a small part in it, and I didn't know what his name was. And I was casting a show, and I was like, I want that guy, and I don't know who he is, but I want him. And while I was casting, I walked into the elevator, and there he was. And it was Mickey Rourke, a young Mickey Rourke, who had not done any films yet. I guess he had done one film, maybe. But
So then and there, did you say, I've been looking all over
you? I did. I said, I've been looking for you. And he couldn't do it. But it was, I mean, casting is a strange process. There used to be in Manhattan Plaza, there was in the early days of Manhattan Plaza, there was a restaurant called Curtain Up. And the wall of the curtain of Curtain Up was names of actors. And it was all contemporary actors. And we used to do casting in Curtain Up. We would sit there and say, and just look at the wall, because you'd see the names of specific people who might be right for it, but also it would jog your memory about other people.
How long did you live there?
15 years.
Wow, yeah. I remember when you were there.
I was on tour with the acting company, and I got kicked out of the apartment that I was in. And Manhattan Plaza had just opened, and they were having trouble filling the apartments because it was in a terrible neighborhood. They were beautiful apartments in this awful neighborhood. It was going to be a luxury high-rise, and the company went broke in the 70s. And a guy named Robert Moss, who at that time ran Playwrights Horizons, which was an off-Broadway theater in the city. His office was across the street from these buildings, and he would stare at these buildings every day and think, something has to happen with those buildings. And finally he thought, Actors Equity should do something with these buildings. And he called Equity, and he got Equity interested, and it became subsidized housing. And it helped countless actors, writers, musicians, directors, be able to afford to live in New York City because it was subsidized housing. I had a terrace. I was coming from a tiny little studio apartment that kept getting robbed, and I suddenly was in this beautiful building with a terrace and a gorgeous view of the river, and I felt like I was in the seat of luxury.
Now it's become kind of a hip neighborhood.
Now it's become a very hip neighborhood. Actually, I had friends when I first moved there, which was like 35 years ago now. And I had friends who had money and were into real estate. And I would stand on my terrace and look down at these derelict buildings that were for sale. And I kept saying, you should buy these buildings. This is going to make you a lot of money. And they didn't do it. And now it's one of the hippest neighborhoods in New York.
So how did you end up getting the gig at Rutgers?
I knew people. I mean, that's again, they were looking for somebody to teach directing, an adjunct to teach directing part-time. And as it turned out, I knew everybody who was on the executive committee of the theater program. I had worked with them all in different capacities. There was a designer I had worked with, a director that I had, the guy who's the head of the directing program, Harold Scott. I had been on a panel with William Esper, who was the head of the program, who was a master acting teacher who has a house in Copake and a studio in New York City that's one of the best studios in the country and most important studios in the country. And I knew Bill from 20 years before when I had worked at St. Nicholas Theater Company in Chicago, which was run by David Mamet, who had been a student of Bill's. And David Mamet and Bill Macy and Stephen Chatner ran that company. And they had a theater school there that was run by somebody who had been a student of Bill's, and Bill was the mentor of that theater program. So he knew about me, I knew about him, and when it was time to hire somebody, he was like, yes, let's get Amy Saltz.
And so now you still direct.
I still direct, yeah. As I said, I'm going off to Boise to do a show there, and I had this production of in Hartford in the spring. And I've also been able to say yes now because I'm not at Rutgers anymore. So I'm able to say yes to things that come my way, which I haven't been able to do very much of for the last 12 years. So I've been involved with a documentary film that a woman named Deborah Anderson is making. Deborah is the daughter of a man who was a pilot in Vietnam, an American pilot who was shot down in Vietnam. And 2 years ago, we went to Vietnam for the 40th anniversary of his plane being shot down. And we went to the crash site, and we went to where the body is buried. We met townspeople who had seen both and been involved with both from the ground. We met the people who buried her father's body. It was an extraordinary trip. And and we filmed it. We had two cameramen with us and a translator as we traipsed through the Vietnamese countryside, which was a profound experience, having been a major anti-war person, to suddenly be in the middle of the place where it really happened with the daughter of somebody, an American pilot, who was killed there. It was very profound. Anyway, so we're working on that. I got to go to Estonia to do a playwrights conference there last summer. I'm now just starting to get involved with a playwright on a play about 9/11. There are just all these things that I have time for now. And as I want to open my horizons, I'm incredibly excited when somebody comes and says, hey, would you be interested in whatever it may be?
Were you, you were at Wisconsin in the 60s, I guess.
I was.
So that was certainly an anti-war.
It was a big anti-war. And I had friends who were, you know, major activists in the anti-war movement out there. And I was doing theater. But I had a theater company that called the Freedom Theater that I started, the Madison Freedom Theater, that was to raise money and awareness about the war. And we had our first production was Mother Courage, and we had big panel discussions afterwards with members of the professors from the history department and Asian studies and activists and army people. I mean, it was just lots of activist theater.
And had you started all this at a very early age? I mean, putting on skits and shows and plays and things?
Oh, God. I was in love with theater from the time I was about 2 years old on. And my mother taught me how to type because she thought, you know, it was the 50s. And it's like, well, a woman has to know how to type. And if you know how to type, you can always be a typist. And you can always get a job at the very least. Now it would be computer programming probably, but in those days it was typing. So by the time I got to, I was in junior high school and I had to take a typing class, and I already knew how to type. So I spent that class typing up the script for South Pacific that we were going to do as a class project. And so I was in South Pacific while everybody else was learning their ABCs on the typewriter. But I would do anything. At that time, I would do anything to be around theater.
Where did you go to school?
I grew up in Brooklyn, and so I went to public school. I went to PS8, and then I went to PS20, and then junior high school 117. But anyway, I was in Brooklyn, and then I went to a private school in Manhattan for high school, because my local high school, where I would have had to go if I had stayed in public school, was a really terrible school, and there were a lot of knifings there, and there was a lot of bad stuff going on there, and it was a dangerous place for a kid.
How did you choose Wisconsin then for university?
It was the furthest away from home that my parents would let me go, and also my cousin had gone to school there, and I thought he was just the greatest, and also there was a French teacher there, a woman named Germaine Bray, who was an expert in existentialism, and she was French, and she had known Camus, and I was like, I want to go study with Germaine Bray.
And French was your major, actually.
French was my major, because I wanted to get an education. I knew I was going to be doing theater, but I wanted to get an education. I thought I would get a better education if I majored in French than if I majored in theater, which turned out to be true. And then I bribed my parents to let me go to France for the summer of my junior year. And I said, you know, I need this. And if I'm really going to be a French major, I need to go to France so that I can make my French better. And if you don't do that, I'm just going to have to become a theater major. And they were like, no, we're going to send you to France for the summer. So, and I'm about to go back there, and it's the first time I've been back since that summer.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Huh. Yeah. You're going back on a project? Or just,
no, my partner and I are going to go take a trip.
Uh-huh. When are you doing that?
In the spring.
Uh-huh. Well, have fun.
Thank you. I'm very excited. If anybody has any suggestions of where I should go, things to do, places to stay, I'm up for it. Of course, we're going to go to all the Impressionists. I mean, I think this is largely going to be an Impressionist view of France. We're going to go to Provence also.
Oh, yes.
And, uh-huh. Yeah, and probably base ourselves in Arles.
Well, so you'll be able to practice your French as well.
Yeah. I just bought Rosetta Stone, so I can do that.
How do people get into the theater these days? They go to school? How do you sort of break into it?
By doing it is whatever that may mean. I think these days it's very hard to break into the professional world without having gone through an MFA program or a very reputable BFA program, because there are so many of these programs all over the country. And some of them, not all of them, a lot of them are terrible, but a few of them are good. And they give you access to it. Because there are so many of them, it becomes very hard to just come raw and be taken seriously, unless you're in a community where you can really work a lot with good people and learn the skills yourself. Well, I mean, kind of what I did, and then be lucky enough to make some kind of connections that you can follow through with. Or, I mean, there are things that can come from out of town and then come into New York and make a splash, and then that gives you the connections, to the entree to other people. But without somehow having a way in, it's very, very hard. And it's very hard in New York City because the city itself is so expensive. So where I could live, my first apartment was, I paid $66 a month on the Lower East Side, it was on 6th Street and 2nd Avenue across the street from Fillmore East. But it was $66 a month. And granted, that was, you know, that was more than, or a lot less than $66 a month would be today. But it was still doable for somebody. But today, when my students would be graduating from Rutgers, for them to live in New York is insane. I mean, apartments are, I don't know, if you can get an apartment for one person for $2,500 a month, that's a really good deal. So people are living three or four in an apartment and working waitress jobs or whatever to be able to, or waiter jobs to be able to support themselves. And it's just very, very, very hard.
Now, in theaters, regional theaters, are people who are acting acting for these theaters, are they doing it as a profession? Are they doing it full time?
Some do. I mean, there are some communities like Seattle and Chicago, maybe Atlanta, where there's enough theater going. Boston certainly, where there's enough theater going on that somebody actually could make a living doing it. In small communities, it's hard to imagine. Except there are places like this Boise, the theater that I'm going to be working in Boise. They have very few people who are there full time, who are full-time members of that theater. There's also a Boise Shakespeare Festival that has, I don't know whether they have a resident company, they may, but there are certainly people from the area who work there a lot. And the Boise Shakespeare Festival is also connected to Great Lakes Shakespeare Festival, which is full year round in Cleveland, and so they move shows back and forth. Then in Louisville, there's Actors Theater of Louisville that has a resident company. They also bring people in for their, they have a big Humana Festival, which is a big new play festival, and they bring a lot of new people in just for that. But there's a resident company there. So it varies. There are communities that can support resident companies.
When you go, how long do you spend in one of these places? A month or so?
Usually about a month. Yeah, I mean, these days it's usually 3 weeks of rehearsal and then the first week of previews through opening, and then I usually go back and check it during the course of the run a couple of times.
And by now, I suppose you encounter the same actors over and over, right? I mean, there are people you've worked with many times, I suppose.
There are, and also I wasn't doing as much of this for a while, so there are lots and lots of new people that I don't know yet.
It's sort of fun. Huh?
It's great. It's both great and it's also frustrating when I'm casting. If I don't have a really good casting director who can bring the people in, it's frustrating because I don't have a list of current people who are of the right, you know, the right age or the right whatever. So I'm a little bit limited if I have to do it by myself.
What is the special talent of a casting director?
That's a really interesting question. I think they have to be able to identify real talent, and they have to be able to work with the director to understand what it is that the director really wants, how the director really sees a role. But a really good casting director can also sometimes help the director conceive of something or see a role being played in a different way. For instance, a classic example of this is when, I think it was Peter Weir, was directing The Year of Living Dangerously. This was probably 20 years ago. Pat McCorkle, who's a brilliant casting director, was working with him. And he needed a role of a small Chinaman. And they couldn't find the right person. And it was a major role in the film, so it had to be somebody who was really good. And Pat had the off-the-wall idea of using a small actress, specifically Linda Hunt. And Peter Weir was like, no, that's a terrible idea. We can't have a woman playing this role. And Pat said, well, let's just give her a screen test. Let's let her try. And they did. And she was wonderful. And they put her on, because Peter Weir really didn't want to have a woman making believe she was a man. And he didn't think it was going to be good for the film. And they put her on a retainer while they kept looking for somebody else. And then finally they couldn't find anybody else. And they needed to start shooting. And Linda got the part. And it became, I think she won an Academy Award for it. It became a huge revolutionary thing that this brilliant actress was able to portray this Chinaman. And Linda was unknown at that time. She was able to portray that Chinaman, and people totally believed it until the end of the movie. They thought that, oh my God, this was a woman playing that role. But that was Pat. And then ultimately it was Peter Weir being courageous enough to try it, or to go with it, or desperate enough to go with it. But a good casting director is an amazing gift for me. I mean, as a director, it's a wonderful, wonderful gift. Because basically they'll bring people in for me to see, for the director to see. I can request people, and they'll try to get them and bring them in. But so if there are people that I want to want to see, I'll give them the names of those people. But then they're going to bring in other people that I don't know. Or I had a casting director once. This was one of those guffaws. I was doing a reading of a play. It was a commercial play that we were doing, and we were having a backers audition, basically. And I needed an actor who could play lots of different roles. One actor had to play a lot of different roles in the same piece, and had to be really versatile and really smart and funny. And Meg Simon was my casting director, and Meg said, I have somebody for you. You've never heard of her, but she's going to be really big, and she's wonderful, and she's about to burst. And I wouldn't do it because I didn't want somebody I didn't know. It was Glenn Close. So that's it. That's in that area. What is she that could have?
Well, you've had an exciting life, haven't you?
I have. I've had a pretty amazing life. I count myself really, really lucky. I fought hard every step of the way.
You worked hard, I'm sure, yeah.
Yeah. I had a dream of being a director, and I didn't let anything get in my way. Now, I paid a price for that. I mean, it wreaked havoc on my personal life for a long, long time. I mean, I have somebody now who I very luckily have been with for 20 years, and it's been pretty amazing. But for a long time, I was so focused on the career, and I could never figure out how people could do both, how they could really be in the theater and be really active as one needs to be, and have enough time and energy and enough of themselves available to be in.
I think theater takes more time probably than any other field.
Maybe. It did for me. And touring. I mean, touring is hard. It's wonderful. I mean, you get to see amazing places and meet amazing people. And I wouldn't give that up for the world, you know, that I got to do that for as long as I got to do it. But it also means that there's somebody at home, or who's taking care of the cat. I had a cat that I took with me for a long time who became a crazy cat. He just became this crazy little animal. he never knew when I was going to pick him up and put him in a box and take him someplace.
Now, do you think situation changed for women directors by now?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's still a struggle, but there are lots and lots and lots of very well-established women directors now, which I think is pretty wonderful. I also think a lot of men go off to Hollywood, and that's starting to happen for the women, too. But a lot of the men, there was a whole period, actually, when I was in New York, and I was doing very well, and most of the men that I knew, of my peers, my colleagues, were going to L.A., and they were doing television. And some of them were doing very well in television, and I had offers to come out. And I thought, what am I going to do? If I go out, at best, I'll get a, a sitcom and maybe make a lot of money, but I'm not going to be happy doing that. It's not who I am. It's just not my life. So I didn't go. And I'll never know what might have happened if I had gone. But the doors are opening all over. And again, a lot of women have worked really hard to prove themselves and to do extraordinary work. And so more doors have opened for more people. We also lost a lot of men, incredibly talented people, into the AIDS epidemic that decimated the artistic community. And what we'll never know of the creations that would have happened, who knows? But there were so many majorly talented people whose careers were just, whose lives and careers, I should say.
In all the arts, yeah.
In all the arts. It's staggering how much. Yeah.
Well, Amy, thank you very much. This has been very interesting.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure.